her face stern, open, and quietly defiant. "How much do you know about that?" Nothing that he told me in words. Everything that the tone of his voice told me whenever he spoke of you. She inclined her head. She had caught the sound of suffering in the faintest exaggeration of evenness in his voice. He pressed the starter. The motor's explosion blasted the story contained in the silence, and they drove on. The path widened a little, streaming toward a pool of sunlight ahead. She saw a brief glitter of wires among the branches as they drove out into a clearing. An unobtrusive little structure stood against a hillside on a rising slant of rocky ground. It was a simple cube of granite the size of a tool shed. It had no windows, no apertures of any kind, only a door of polished steel, and a complex set of wire antennae branching out from the roof. Galt was driving past, leaving it unnoticed, when she asked with a sudden start, "What's that?" She saw the faint break of his smile. "The powerhouse." "Oh, stop, please." He obeyed, backing the car to the foot of the hillside. It was her first few steps up the rocky incline that stopped her, as if there were no need to move forward, no further place to rise. And she stood as in the moment when she had opened her eyes on the earth of the valley, a moment uniting her beginning to her goal. She stood looking up at the structure, her consciousness surrendered to a single sight and a single wordless emotion. But she had always known that an emotion was a sum totaled by an adding machine of the mind, and what she now felt was the instantaneous total of the thoughts she did not have to name, the final sum of a long progression, like a voice telling her by means of a feeling. If she had held on to Quentin Daniels, with no hope of a chance to use the motor, for the sole sake of knowing that achievement had not died on Earth, if, like a weighted diver sinking in an ocean of mediocrity, under the pressure of men with gelatin eyes, rubber voices, spiral-shaped convictions, non-committal souls and non-committing hands, she had held, as her lifeline an oxygen tube, the thought of a superlative achievement of the human mind. If, at the sight of the motor's remnant, in a sudden gasp of suffocation, as a last protest from his corruption-eaten lungs, Dr. Stadler had cried for something, not to look down at, but up to, and this had been the cry, the longing, and the fuel of her life. If she had moved, drawn by the hunger of her youth for a sight of clean, hard, radiant competence, then here it was, before her. Reached and done. The power of an incomparable mind given shape in a net of wires sparkling peacefully under a summer sky, drawing an incalculable power out of space into the secret interior of a small stone hovel. She thought of this structure, half the size of a boxcar, replacing the power plants of the country, the enormous conglomerations of steel, fuel, and effort. She thought of the current flowing from this structure, lifting ounces, pounds, tons of strain from the shoulders of those who would make it or use it, adding hours, days, and years of liberated time to their lives, be it an extra moment to lift one's head from one's task and glance at the sunlight, or an extra pack of cigarettes bought with the money saved from one's electric bill, or an hour cut from the workday of every factory using power, or a month's journey through the whole open width of the world on a ticket paid for by one day of one's labor, on a train pulled by the power of this motor. With all the energy of that weight, that strain, that time, replaced and paid for by the energy of a single mind, who had known how to make connections of wire, follow the connections of his thought. But she knew that there was no meaning in motors or factories or trains, that their only meaning was in man's enjoyment of his life, which they served, and that her swelling admiration at the sight of an achievement was for the man from whom it came, for the power and the radiant vision within him which had seen the earth as a place of enjoyment, and had known that the work of achieving one's happiness was the purpose, the sanction, and the meaning of life. The door of the structure was a straight, smooth sheet of stainless steel, soft, lustrous, and bluish in the sun. Above it, cut in the granite, is the only feature of the building's rectangular austerity. There stood an inscription. "I swear by my life and my love of it, that I will never live for the sake of another man, nor ask another man to live for mine." She turned to Galt. He stood beside her. He had followed her. He had known that this salute was his. She was looking at the inventor of the motor, but what she saw was the easy, casual figure of a workman in his natural setting and function. She noted the uncommon lightness of his posture, a weightless way of standing that showed an expert control of the use of his body, a tall body in simple garments, a thin shirt, light slacks, a belt about a slender waistline, and loose hair made to glitter like metal by the current of a sluggish wind. She looked at him as she had looked at his structure. Then she knew that the first two sentences they had said to each other still hung between them, filling the silence. That everything said since had been said over the sound of those words. That he had known it, had held it, had not let her forget it. She was suddenly aware that they were alone. It was an awareness that stressed the fact, permitting no further implication, yet holding the full meaning of the unnamed in that special stress. They were alone, in a silent forest, at the foot of a structure that looked like an ancient temple. And she knew what rite was the proper form of worship to be offered on an altar of that kind. She felt a sudden pressure at the base of her throat. Her head leaned back a little, no more than to feel the faint shift of a current against her hair. But it was as if she were lying back in space against the wind, conscious of nothing but his legs and the shape of his mouth. He stood watching her, his face still, but for the faint movement of his eyelids drawing narrow as if against too strong a light. It was like the beat of three instants. This was the first. And in the next, she felt a stab of ferocious triumph at the knowledge that his effort and his struggle were harder to endure than hers. And then he moved his eyes and raised his head to look at the inscription on the temple. She let him look at it for a moment, almost as an act of condescending mercy to an adversary struggling to refuel his strength. Then she asked, with a note of imperious pride in her voice, pointing at the inscription, "What's that?" "It's the oath that was taken by every person in this valley but you," she said, looking at the words. "This has always been my own rule of living." "I know it. But I don't think that yours is the way to practice it." "Then you'll have to learn which one of us is wrong." She walked up to the steel door of the structure with a sudden confidence faintly stressed in the movements of her body. A mere hint of stress, no more than her awareness of the power she held by means of his pain. And she tried, asking no permission, to turn the knob of the door. But the door was locked, and she felt no tremor under the pressure of her hand, as if the lock were poured and sealed to the stone with the solid steel of the sheet. "Don't try to open that door, Miss Taggart." He approached her, his steps a shade too slow, as if stressing his knowledge of her awareness of every step. "No amount of physical force will do it," he said. "Only a thought can open that door. If you tried to break it down by means of the best explosives in the world, the machinery inside would collapse into rubble long before the door would give way. But reach the thought which it requires, and the secret of the motor will be yours, as well as—" it was the first break she had heard in his voice— "as well as any other secret you might wish to know." He faced her for a moment, as if leaving himself open to her full understanding, then smiled oddly, quietly, at some thought of his own, and added, "I'll show you how it's done." He stepped back. Then, standing still, his face raised to the words carved in the stone, he repeated them slowly, evenly, as if taking that oath once more. There was no emotion in his voice. Nothing but the spaced clarity of the sounds he pronounced, with full knowledge of their meaning. But she knew that she was witnessing the most solemn moment it would ever be given to her to witness. She was seeing a man's naked soul, and the cost it had paid to utter these words. She was hearing an echo of the day when he had pronounced that oath for the first time, and with full knowledge of the years ahead. She knew what manner of man had stood up to face 6,000 others on a dark spring night, and why they had been afraid of him. She knew that this was the birth and the core of all the things that had happened to the world in the 12 years since. She knew that this was of far greater import than the motor hidden inside the structure. She knew it, to the sound of a man's voice pronouncing in self-reminder and rededication, "I swear by my life and my love of it that I will never live for the sake of another man, nor ask another man to live for mine." It did not startle her. It seemed unastonishing and almost unimportant that at the end of the last sound she saw the door opening slowly without human touch, moving inward upon a growing strip of darkness. In the moment when an electric light went on inside the structure, he seized the knob and pulled the door shut, its lock clicking sealed once more. "It's a sound lock," he said. His face was serene. "That sentence is the combination of sounds needed to open it. I don't mind telling you this secret, because I know that you won't pronounce those words until you mean them the way I intended them to be meant." She inclined her head. "I won't." She followed him down to the car, slowly, feeling suddenly too exhausted to move. She fell back against the seat, closing her eyes, barely hearing the sound of the starter. The accumulated strain and shock of her sleepless hours hit her at once, breaking through the barrier of the tension her nerves had held to delay it. She lay still, unable to think, to react, or to struggle, drained of all emotions but one. She did not speak. She did not open her eyes until the car stopped in front of his house. "You'd better rest," he said, "and go to sleep right now if you want to attend Mulligan's dinner tonight." She nodded obediently. She staggered to the house, avoiding his help. She made an effort to tell him, "I'll be all right," then to escape to the safety of her room, and last long enough to close the door. She collapsed face down on the bed. It was not the mere fact of physical exhaustion. It was the sudden monomania of a sensation too complete to endure. While the strength of her body was gone, while her mind had lost the faculty of consciousness, a single emotion drew on her remnants of energy, of understanding, of judgment, of control, leaving her nothing to resist it with or to direct it, making her unable to desire, only to feel, reducing her to a mere sensation, a static sensation without start or goal. She kept seeing his figure in her mind, his figure as he had stood at the door of the structure. She felt nothing else, no wish, no hope, no estimate of her feeling, no name for it, no relation to herself. There was no entity such as herself. She was not a person. Only a function, the function of seeing him, and the sight was its own meaning and purpose, with no further end to reach. Her face buried in the pillow, she recalled dimly as a faint sensation the moment of her takeoff from the floodlighted strip of the Kansas airfield. She felt the beat of the engine, the streak of accelerating motion gathering power in a straight line run to a single goal. And in the moment when the wheels left the ground, she was asleep. The floor of the valley was like a pool, still reflecting the glow of the sky. But the light was thickening from gold to copper. The shores were fading, and the peaks were smoke blue when they drove to Mulligan's house. There was no trace of exhaustion left in her bearing, and no remnant of violence. She had awakened at sundown, stepping out of her room. She had found Galt waiting, sitting idly motionless in the light of a lamp. He had glanced up at her. She had stood in the doorway, her face composed, her hair smooth, her posture relaxed and confident. She had looked as she would have looked on the threshold of her office in the Taggart Building, but for the slight angle of her body leaning on a cane. He had sat looking at her for a moment, and she had wondered why she had felt certain that this was the image he was seeing. He was seeing the doorway of her office, as if it were a sight long imagined and long forbidden. She sat beside him in the car, feeling no desire to speak, knowing that neither of them could conceal the meaning of their silence. She watched a few lights come up in the distant homes of the valley, then the lighted windows of Mulligan's house on the ledge ahead. She asked, "Who will be there?" "Some of your last friends," he answered, "and some of my first." Midas Mulligan met them at the door. She noticed that his grim, square face was not as harshly expressionless as she had thought. He had a look of satisfaction, but satisfaction could not soften his features. It merely struck them like flint and sent sparks of humor to glitter faintly in the corners of his eyes, a humor that was shrewder, more demanding, yet warmer than a smile. He opened the door of his house, moving his arm a shade more slowly than normal, giving an imperceptibly solemn emphasis to his gesture. Walking into the living room, she faced seven men who rose to their feet at her entrance. "Gentlemen, Taggart Transcontinental," said Midas Mulligan. He said it smiling, but only half jesting. Some quality in his voice made the name of the railroad sound as it would have sounded in the days of Nat Taggart, as a sonorous title of honor. She inclined her head slowly, in acknowledgment to the men before her, knowing that these were the men whose standards of value and honor were the same as her own, the men who recognized the glory of that title as she recognized it, knowing with a sudden stab of wistfulness how much she had longed for that recognition through all her years. Her eyes moved slowly in greeting from face to face. Ellis Wyatt, Ken Daniger, Hugh Axton, Dr. Hendricks, Quentin Daniels. Mulligan's voice pronounced the names of the two others. Richard Halley, Judge Narragansett. The faint smile on Richard Halley's face seemed to tell her that they had known each other for years, as in her lonely evenings by the side of her phonograph they had. The austerity of Judge Narragansett's white-haired figure reminded her that she had once heard him described as a marble statue, a blindfolded marble statue. It was the kind of figure that had vanished from the courtrooms of the country when the gold coins had vanished from the country's hands.
"You have belonged here for a long time, Miss Taggart," said Midas Mulligan. "This was not the way we expected you to come, but welcome home."
"No," she wanted to answer, but heard herself answering softly, "Thank you."
"Dagny, how many years is it going to take you to learn to be yourself?"
It was Ellis Wyatt grasping her elbow, leading her to a chair, grinning at her look of helplessness, at the struggle between a smile and a tightening resistance in her face.
"Don't pretend that you don't understand us. You do."
"We never make assertions, Miss Taggart," said Hugh Axton. "That is the moral crime peculiar to our enemies. We do not tell, we show. We do not claim, we prove. It is not your obedience that we seek to win, but your rational conviction. You have seen all the elements of our secret. The conclusion is now yours to draw. We can help you to name it, but not to accept it. The sight, the knowledge, and the acceptance must be yours." "I feel as if I know it," she answered simply. "And more. I feel as if I've always known it, but never found it. And now I'm afraid, not afraid to hear it, just afraid that it's coming so close."
Axton smiled.
"What does this look like to you, Miss Taggart?" He pointed around the room. "This?" She laughed suddenly, looking at the faces of the men against the golden sunburst of rays filling the great windows. "This looks like... You know, I never hoped to see any of you again. I wondered at times how much I'd give for just one more glimpse or one more word. And now... Now this is like that dream you imagine in childhood, when you think that someday in heaven you will see those great departed whom you had not seen on earth, and you choose from all the past centuries the great men you would like to meet."
"Well, that's one clue to the nature of our secret," said Axton. "Ask yourself whether the dream of heaven and greatness should be left waiting for us in our graves, or whether it should be ours here and now, and on this earth."
"I know," she whispered.
"And if you met those great men in heaven," asked Ken Daniger, "what would you want to say to them?"
Just hello, I guess."
"That's not all," said Daniger. "There's something you'd want to hear from them. I didn't know it either until I saw him for the first time."
He pointed to Galt,
and he said it to me, and then I knew what it was that I'd missed all my life. "Miss Taggart, you'd want them to look at you and to say, 'Well done.'"
She dropped her head and nodded silently, head down, not to let him see the sudden spurt of tears to her eyes.
"All right, then. Well done, Dagny. Well done. Too well. And now it's time for you to rest from that burden which none of us should ever have had to carry." "Shut up," said Midas Mulligan, looking at her bowed head with anxious concern.
But she raised her head, smiling. "Thank you," she said to Daniger.
"If you talk about resting, then let her rest," said Mulligan. "She said too much for one day."
"No," she smiled. "Go ahead, say it, whatever it is."
"Later," said Mulligan.
It was Mulligan and Axton who served dinner, with Quentin Daniels to help them. They served it on small silver trays to be placed on the arms of the chairs, and they all sat about the room with the fire of the sky fading in the windows and sparks of electric light glittering in the wine glasses. There was an air of luxury about the room, but it was the luxury of expert simplicity. She noted the costly furniture, carefully chosen for comfort,
bought somewhere at a time when luxury had still been an art. There were no superfluous objects, but she noticed a small canvas by a great master of the Renaissance worth a fortune. She noticed an oriental rug of a texture and color that belonged under glass in a museum. This was Mulligan's concept of wealth, she thought. The wealth of selection, not of accumulation. Quentin Daniels sat on the floor with his tray on his lap. He seemed completely at home, and he glanced up at her once in a while, grinning like an impudent kid brother who had beaten her to a secret she had not discovered. He had preceded her into the valley by some 10 minutes, she thought. But he was one of them, while she was still a stranger. Galt sat aside, beyond the circle of lamplight, on the arm of Dr. Axton's chair. He had not said a word. He had stepped back and turned her over to the others, and he sat watching it as a spectacle in which he had no further part to play. But her eyes kept coming back to him, drawn by the certainty that the spectacle was of his choice and staging, that he had set it in motion long ago, and that all the others knew it as she knew it. She noticed another person who was intensely aware of Galt's presence. Hugh Axton glanced up at him once in a while, involuntarily, almost surreptitiously, as if struggling not to confess the loneliness of a long separation. Axton did not speak to him, as if taking his presence for granted. But once, when Galt bent forward and a strand of hair fell down across his face, Axton reached over and brushed it back, his hand lingering for an imperceptible instant on his pupil's forehead. It was the only break of emotion he permitted himself, the only greeting. It was the gesture of a father. She found herself talking to the men around her, relaxing in light-hearted comfort. No, she thought. What she felt was not strain. It was a dim astonishment at the strain which she should but did not feel. The abnormality of it was that it seemed so normal and simple. She was barely aware of her questions as she spoke to one man after another, but their answers were printing a record in her mind, moving sentence by sentence to a goal. "The Fifth Concerto," said Richard Halley in answer to her question. "I wrote it 10 years ago. We call it the Concerto of Deliverance. Thank you for recognizing it from a few notes whistled in the night." "Yes, I know about that." "Yes, since you knew my work, you would know when you heard it that this concerto said everything I had been struggling to say and reach. It's dedicated to him." He pointed to Galt. "Why, no, Miss Taggart, I haven't given up music. What makes you think so? I've written more in the last 10 years than in any other period of my life. I will play it for you, any of it, when you come to my house." "No, Miss Taggart, it will not be published outside. Not a note of it will be heard beyond these mountains." "No, Miss Taggart, I've not given up medicine," said Dr. Hendricks in answer to her question. "I've spent the last 6 years on research. I have discovered a method to protect the blood vessels of the brain from that fatal rupture which is known as a brain stroke. It will remove from human existence the terrible threat of sudden paralysis." "No, not a word of my method will be heard outside." "The law, Miss Taggart," said Judge Narragansett. "What law?" "I did not give it up. It has ceased to exist. But I am still working in the profession I had chosen, which was that of serving the cause of justice." "No, justice has not ceased to exist. How could it? It is possible for men to abandon their sight of it, and then it is justice that destroys them. But it is not possible for justice to go out of existence, because one is an attribute of the other, because justice is the act of acknowledging that which exists. Yes, I am continuing in my profession. I am writing a treatise on the philosophy of law. I shall demonstrate that humanity's darkest evil, the most destructive horror machine among all the devices of men, is non-objective law. No, Miss Taggart, my treatise will not be published outside."
"My business, Miss Taggart," said Midas Mulligan. "My business is blood transfusion, and I'm still doing it. My job is to feed a life fuel into the plants that are capable of growing. But ask Dr. Hendricks whether any amount of blood will save a body that refuses to function, a rotten hulk that expects to exist without effort. My blood bank is gold. Gold is a fuel that will perform wonders. But no fuel can work where there is no motor. No, I haven't given up. I merely got fed up with the job of running a slaughterhouse where one drains blood out of healthy living beings and pumps it into gutless half-corpses."
"Given up?" said Hugh Axton. Check your premises, Miss Taggart. None of us has given up. It is the world that has. What is wrong with a philosopher running a roadside diner, or a cigarette factory as I'm doing now? All work is an act of philosophy. And when men will learn to consider productive work and that which is its source as the standard of their moral values, they will reach that state of perfection which is the birthright they lost. The source of work? Man's mind, Miss Taggart. Man's reasoning mind. I am writing a book on this subject, defining a moral philosophy that I learned from my own pupil. Yes, it could save the world. No, it will not be published outside.
Why? She cried. Why? What are you doing, all of you?
We are on strike, said John Galt. They all turned to him, as if they'd been waiting for his voice and for that word. She heard the empty beat of time within her, which was the sudden silence of the room as she looked at him across a span of lamplight. He sat slouched casually on the arm of a chair leaning forward, his forearm across his knees, his hand hanging down idly. And it was the faint smile on his face that gave to his words the deadly sound of the irrevocable. Why should this seem so startling? There is only one kind of men who have never been on strike in human history. Every other kind and class have stopped when they so wished, and have presented demands to the world claiming to be indispensable. Except the men who have carried the world on their shoulders, have kept it alive, have endured torture as sole payment, but have never walked out on the human race. Well, their turn has come. Let the world discover who they are, what they do, and what happens when they refuse to function. This is the strike of the men of the mind, Miss Taggart. This is the mind on strike. She did not move, except for the fingers of one hand that moved slowly up her cheek to her temple. Through all the ages, he said, the mind has been regarded as evil and every form of insult, from heretic to materialist to exploiter, every form of iniquity, from exile to disenfranchisement to expropriation, every form of torture, from sneers to rack to firing squad, have been brought down upon those who assume the responsibility of looking at the world through the eyes of a living consciousness and performing the crucial act of a rational connection. Yet only to the extent to which, in chains, in dungeons, in hidden corners, in the cells of philosophers, in the shops of traders, some men continued to think, only to that extent was humanity able to survive. Through all the centuries of the worship of the mindless, whatever stagnation humanity chose to endure, whatever brutality to practice, it was only by the grace of the men who perceived that wheat must have water in order to grow, that stones laid in a curve will form an arch, that two and two makes four, that love is not served by torture and life is not fed by destruction. Only by the grace of those men did the rest of them learn to experience moments when they caught the spark of being human, and only the sum of such moments permitted them to continue to exist. It was the man of the mind who taught them to bake their bread, to heal their wounds, to forge their weapons, and to build the jails into which they threw him. He was the man of extravagant energy and reckless generosity, who knew that stagnation is not man's fate, that impotence is not his nature, that the ingenuity of his mind is his noblest and most joyous power. And in service to that love of existence he was alone to feel, he went on working, working at any price, working for his despoilers, for his jailers, for his torturers, paying with his life for the privilege of saving theirs. This was his glory and his guilt, that he let them teach him to feel guilty of his glory, to accept the part of a sacrificial animal, and in punishment for the sin of intelligence to perish on the altars of the brutes. The tragic joke of human history is that on any of the altars men erected, it was always man whom they immolated, and the animal whom they enshrined. It was always the animal's attributes, not man's, that humanity worshipped, the idol of instinct and the idol of force, the mystics and the kings. The mystics, who longed for an irresponsible consciousness and ruled by means of the claim that their dark emotions were superior to reason, that knowledge came in blind, causeless fits, blindly to be followed, not doubted. And the kings, who ruled by means of claws and muscles, with conquest as their method and looting as their aim, with a club or a gun as sole sanction of their power. The defenders of man's soul were concerned with his feelings, and the defenders of man's body were concerned with his stomach, but both were united against his mind. Yet no one, Not the lowest of humans is ever able fully to renounce his brain. No one has ever believed in the irrational. What they do believe in is the unjust. Whenever a man denounces the mind, it is because his goal is of a nature the mind would not permit him to confess. When he preaches contradictions, he does so in the knowledge that someone will accept the burden of the impossible. Someone will make it work for him at the price of his own suffering or life. Destruction.